Last time we talked about the huge variety of functions that proteins in general perform. Of course, each function is performed by a specific protein. It's not that one protein can do all those jobs. But anyway, slide 16 just shows you one example. It was the first example in that first functional category in that table, I think, in the previous list, which is enzymes. Enzymes are catalysts. And catalysts, in general, are substances that drastically speed up chemical reactions. This is a huge fraction of your total number of proteins that you're able to build. What is it that determines which particular proteins you're able to build? Your genes. That's why you're stuck with only those proteins for your life, because your cells have to have instructions for how to build them. And a big fraction of your thousands of kinds of proteins that you're able to make are specifically acting as enzymes. This is just how an enzyme works schematically. The purple thing is the enzyme. And the reaction that's occurring here is what kind of reaction? Well, what kind of reaction splits a bigger thing into smaller things? Hydrolysis, right? That's why it requires water. Water itself gets split into H and OH so that you can stick a little piece onto each of the two chunks. And that is possible without the help of the enzyme. But when the enzyme's there, it makes it happen a hell of a lot quicker, usually millions of times faster. And all of the thousands of different kinds of reactions that make up metabolism, your life, wouldn't happen soon enough for you to stay alive if it weren't for enzymes speeding them up. So just one really important function of proteins in general. Let's go to 17 now. And 17 is not a protein. This is not a polypeptide. Just like when we started the section on polysaccharides, we didn't launch right into a polysaccharide, right? We looked at monosaccharides, which are the building blocks or the monomers that can be put together to build the polymer that's called a polysaccharide. Same thing here. This is not a polypeptide. This is a building block that could be used by hooking it with other ones like it together to make a polypeptide. This is the monomer that all polypeptides are made out of, or a monomer. What is the general name for the monomers that make up polypeptides? Well, linguistically, you might guess that it's peptides because, for instance, monosaccharides make up polysaccharides. But actually, the word polypeptide comes not from the name of the building blocks, but the name of the bonds between them, as we'll talk about in a minute. So this is not a peptide. This is an amino acid. Amino acids are the monomers that make up polypeptides. This is just one amino acid. And it's actually not a particular amino acid. This is just the general scheme for how things have to be arranged in order for that molecule to be considered an amino acid. Every amino acid has this general structure. Now, what is the only letter up here that doesn't represent an element?
R.
There's no R on the periodic table, R by itself. So R, just like for functional groups, stands for the rest, whatever it is. It's the residue. All right? But in order for a molecule to be considered an amino acid, everything else has to be exactly as it is in this picture. There is a central carbon, and carbon, of course, has a valence of 4, so it has to make 4 total bonds. In this case, it's making 4 single bonds. One of those bonds is made with the thing in yellow, which I shouldn't have to tell you, even though it's labeled, is a carboxyl group, right? You should know that by now. You have to have a carboxyl. One of the things hanging on the carbon is just a hydrogen. Another thing is the orange one, which is the amino group. Now remember, when we talked about functional groups, things that contain an amino things that contain a carboxyl are called carboxylic acids, right? And this whole thing is an amino acid because it has an amino group. That's where the amino name comes, part of the name comes from. And it's also a carboxylic acid, so amino acid is the name for the whole thing. Now, the fourth position, which is R here, can be anything at all. Has to be at least one atom. So the simplest possibility is to just put another hydrogen in there, which is one of the amino acids. But the point here is that since R is variable, that means there's really no limit to the number of amino acids that can exist or that you could produce in a laboratory, as long as the rest of it is exactly like this. R can be anything. And not a single atom only. It can be a collection of atoms. All right? So there's no limit to the number of amino acids in general. Go ahead.
Does that mean there could be an amino acid connected to an amino acid?
Yeah, that's where we're getting to, because that's what a polypeptide is.
Oh.
That's what I meant when I said amino acids are the monomers that make up polypeptides. Just like monosaccharides are the monomers that can be hooked together to build polysaccharides. These are the building blocks of proteins. But even though there's no limit to the number of amino acids possible, all organisms, not just now, all organisms throughout the history of life have used the same set of just 20 amino acids. Actually, there's just a couple exceptions to that. So nearly all organisms that have ever existed use the same set of 20. There's many more than that possible. So if you read a textbook that says there are 20 amino acids, that's not true. There is an unlimited number of amino acids. When they talk about the 20 amino acids, they should say the 20 biological amino acids, because that's the ones that have evolved for use in organisms. All right? And by the way, the fact that all organisms, despite that huge variety of that you see in life, the fact that all organisms use the same set of 20 is one of the strongest bits of evidence pointing to the fact that we all descended from the first successful lineage of cells that I keep talking about, the trunk of the tree of life. All right, so that is just the general scheme for an amino acid. Now let's look at the 20 biological amino acids in 18. These are the ones that organisms use. And you'll notice, hopefully, that every one of these structural formulae includes the basic scheme for an amino acid. Everything other than the white highlighted part is identical in all of these. That's what makes each one of these an amino acid. So the white part is the R group for each one. And notice that the glycine is the one I was talking about as the simplest possibility. It's just stick another hydrogen in this place of R. But R can be anything. So these are the 20 that organisms use, and we can subdivide those then based on what the R groups are like. So this first group are the nonpolar amino acids, because the R group is nonpolar. And that's important because what the R group is, the chemical characteristics that it has, determines how it interacts with other amino acids within the same macromolecule, within the same protein. And therefore it determines, as we'll get into, the shape of the protein or the conformation, which is all important because whatever the function is that a particular protein has, that function is possible because of the specific shape that that protein has. And that depends on the interactions between amino acids within that molecule, which depends on the R group characteristics. So you have nonpolar amino acids. You also have ones that with polar R groups. So they're going to interact differently, of course, just like polar things interact differently in general from nonpolar. And then beyond polar is the third one, which is electrically charged. Remember, polar is only partially charged. Electrically charged means fully charged. So there are some ionic R groups. And in fact, you could then subdivide that electrically charged group into two subgroups itself, the acidic and the basic ones. Because the ones with negative charge make the amino acid have acidic properties. Positive charges give them basic properties. All right, you don't have to memorize these 20, but those are the 20, not the 20 that your body uses only, the 20 that organisms all over use. Those are building blocks, though. So in 19, we can see how you can then use these building blocks to build bigger structures. We're on our way to building a polypeptide. And the process has already started because a couple of these amino acids have already been put together. We're going to add a third one. And eventually, when you have many, whatever, there's no official cutoff of between a few and many, or several and many, but that's what polypeptide refers to. Not because of the amino acid, it's not named for the subunits, it's named for the bonds between them. And the bond, the name of the bond between two adjacent amino acids is a peptide bond. Do you remember the other bond names that we talked about? What's the name of the bond between two monosaccharides? Glycosidic linkage. What's the name for a bond between a fatty acid and the glycerol within a fat? Ester linkage, right. Well, here we're giving a different name because it's a bond between different subunits, but it's formed the same way as those other two. Whenever you're hooking two smaller things to make a bigger thing in biology, that involves this kind of reaction, which is what? Dehydration, right. One of the pieces loses an OH, one loses an H, that comes out as water, and now you have a bigger piece. So this bottom part is bigger, it's three amino acids big. That would be considered not officially a polypeptide yet, because three isn't many. It would be called an oligopeptide. Oligo as a prefix means some, but not yet many. There are also oligosaccharides correspondingly. Okay, but there's a couple important things I haven't said about this. One is that there's only one way to link two amino acids in building a polypeptide. In other words, there's only one way to make a peptide bond between two amino acids. And that is if the carboxyl group of one amino acid gets linked to the amino group of the next amino acid, or the other amino acid. And you can see that right here. This was the amino group of this amino acid. This was the carboxyl group. Those are what get hooked together. Carboxyl to amino. No other way. And the reason that's important is that this is unlike the situation with monosaccharides. Remember that monosaccharides have multiple connection points because they have multiple OHs and Hs. And that's why even if you hook a monosaccharide onto an existing monosaccharide, that first monosaccharide still has places where you could hook others, which is why you can branch it. You can't branch a polypeptide because there's only one way to put them together. There's only one carboxyl per amino acid. There's only one amino per amino acid. So there's only one way to hook them together, and they don't branch. It's an end-to-end arrangement of however many amino acids are involved. Another important thing, though, is that I want you to notice that the R groups are therefore not at all involved in holding the polypeptide together. The amino and the carboxyl groups are what hold them together. That's where the peptide bonds are. The R groups are just hanging off of this chain. Each R group is just hanging off of one link of the chain, but it's not holding the chain together. The R groups are just sticking out. They're important because they are going to determine, as we'll see, how this chain, however long it is, will fold up into a three-dimensional shape. But they do not at all hold the thing together along its length. The peptide bonds do that. And so you have the so-called backbone. That is the non-variable part of the amino acids. Because all this stuff in lavender does not vary from one amino acid to another. This is the required part for it to be an amino acid. It's always the same. The only thing that's different is the R groups, and they're not holding it together, so they just form collectively the side chains, as they're called. All right? So that's an oligopeptide, not very big, but you can continue the process. Keep adding one amino acid at a time, and it'll get longer and longer for as long as you want. And some proteins are thousands of amino acids long before the cell finally determines it's done. Oh, one other final thing is that however long a peptide is, two amino acids, a thousand amino acids, however, or even a single amino acid, there is an N-terminus, that's the amino terminus, where the N for nitrogen, and there is the carboxyl terminus, or carboxyl N, the C-terminus, because that has a carbon in it. So there's polarity, not electrical polarity, but there's a difference from one end to the next. There's a nitrogen end, a carbon end, however long you make it. All right, now to 20. You see here just one example of a protein, and it is lysozyme, as you see. The actual example doesn't really matter. That's just a specific example. But you see two versions of it, two representations of the actual protein here. And one of them is a ribbon model, one of them is a space-filling model. They both are valuable because they show you that the overall polypeptide, however long it is, has a specific shape, and that's what gives lysozyme its specific function, this particular shape. But the ribbon model is a little bit better, in my opinion, even though the space-filling model is kind of more realistic. It's not really how atoms look, but it's more realistic than the ribbon. What's nice about the ribbon model, though, is that it reminds you of two important facts. One is that a single polypeptide, no matter how many amino acids are involved, is a non-branching end-to-end arrangement. Just like a ribbon doesn't branch, this purple ribbon has two ends, and it doesn't branch from that end to the others. One long continuous chain of amino acids that it represents. I said there were two important things, right? What the hell else was I thinking of? Well, the yellow things we'll talk more about later. They're not really the point of this slide, but these represent covalent bonds called disulfide bridges. I actually mentioned this just cursorily when we talked about functional groups, when I was talking about the giving you examples of why sulfhydryl groups are important. Remember that as functional groups. If you have two amino acids, but they're not next to each other, they're separated. You know, you have a long chain of amino acids, and if two of them have sulfhydryls, and you fold the whole thing so that the sulfhydryls come in contact with each other, they will lose their hydrogens and the two sulfurs will covalently bond, very much stabilizing the shape of this. That's what those yellow things represent. We'll talk more about that later, though. The groove here is labeled simply because this particular example of a polypeptide, which is lysozyme, is an enzyme. You know it's an enzyme from its name, ending enzyme. So this is another enzyme. This is a particular enzyme. The other one was just a general. But any given enzyme has to have a particular shape. The groove is where the substrate, the thing that it helps turn into product, is able to bind. Okay, now 21 is just another rendition. Actually, there are two proteins being represented here. An antibody protein, which would be from a mammal, maybe a human, and a flu virus, which is a protein as well, but notice their complementary shapes. They match up nicely. This is how immunity works. When you get vaccinated, that spurs your body into producing particularly shaped antibody proteins whose shape perfectly matches or very well matches something you're trying to protect yourself from, like COVID, for instance. Okay, 22. Here we need to talk about the four levels of protein structure. And you can see that the levels are just named for numerical levels. Primary means first, secondary, tertiary means third, quaternary means fourth. All right, so those are the levels. Primary structure, secondary structure, tertiary structure, quaternary structure. Every protein features at least the first three. Only some proteins, in addition to those first three, also feature quaternary structure. And so now I can finally tell you why the words polypeptide and protein sometimes mean the same thing and sometimes don't. All right? Polypeptide as a word shows you linguistically that that is a polymer, right? Made of amino acids, however many, linked together with peptide bonds. The word polypeptide always refers to a single non-branching end-to-end arrangement of amino acids. One ribbon, in other words, in the ribbon model. All right? And that is a complete molecule. A polypeptide is a complete molecule by itself. Well, some proteins are just a single polypeptide. One ribbon makes up the whole protein. In that case, the word polypeptide and the word protein can be used interchangeably. But not all proteins are so simple, even though a single polypeptide can itself be really complex in shape. What I mean is that there are some more complex proteins that are made up of two or more polypeptides. And polypeptides in that case are really just subunits of the overall protein. So in that case, the word protein and the word polypeptide do not mean the same thing. Does that make sense to you? Okay, it'll make more sense hopefully when we get to quaternary structure finally. But let's start with primary, the simplest level. Primary structure refers simply to the particular sequence of amino acids making up a single polypeptide. Any given polypeptide, which is one ribbon, is first of all made up of a specific number of amino acids. Not all polypeptides have the same number. There are smaller ones, longer ones. But however many there are, that's part of primary structure, however many amino acids there are. And it's kind of like stringing together beads. A standard stringing of beads doesn't branch either, right? So you have one string, doesn't branch, and you put beads on it. The beads represent the amino acids. Well, however many beads there are is an important part, however many amino acids there are. But also what kinds of amino acids they are in the particular sequence. For instance, GLY means glycine, you have proline, threonine, you don't have to memorize those names, but these are some of the 20 amino acids that we looked at earlier. If you think about it as building a string of beads, you have a set of beads with 20 different kinds of beads, the biological amino acids. But you can choose any one of the 20 each time you put a new bead on. So think about how many mathematical possibilities there are, even if you only have 100 beads you're going to build. You would have 20 raised to the 100th power. That is an enormous number. That number is far more than the number of atoms than there are in the universe, which you can imagine is quite a huge number. And that's a relatively short protein. So there is no limit to the number of proteins that can be built if you're doing it in a lab, if you're told how to do it. Cells, they'll have to be told by genes. Anyway, the particular sequence of amino acids, including how many there are, makes up the primary structure. When it's built, you can think of it kind of being as a string of beads, all stretched out. That doesn't have a shape yet, or a functional shape yet. So let's go to the higher structural level, the secondary structure. The secondary structure involves whether or not and how many there are of a couple often repeated motifs. You see these patterns in a lot of polypeptides. One pattern is called the beta pleated sheet because it has folds like an accordion. That's the pleats. Okay? Not all polypeptides have them, but many do. Another one that you see a lot is the alpha helix. A helix is a corkscrew shape, like DNA itself is helical. And so, once again, not every polypeptide is going to have these, but if a polypeptide has these, that's part of secondary structure, where they are and how many there are. So secondary structure is not really the entire shape of that single polypeptide yet. It's just part of it, involving these often used patterns. Okay, then the next level, which is tertiary structure, refers to the overall three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide. When you take that necklace or that ribbon and you fold it up in whatever shape it takes, that's the tertiary structure. So, if you are one of those proteins made up of just one polypeptide, then tertiary structure is your entire shape because you are just one polypeptide big. And that's where it would end. There would be no higher level for that kind of protein. That's what I meant by saying that all proteins have at least these first three levels. Okay, well, if you're talking about a more complex protein, the ones that are made of multiple polypeptides, then those proteins are called multimeric proteins. Now, multimer and polymer really mean the same thing, many part. But polymer refers to an individual polypeptide, right? A single ribbon is already a polymer. Some proteins use multiple ribbons. So a multimeric protein is multiple polymers all in one organization. And importantly, however many polypeptides make up the multimeric protein, those constituent polypeptides are not themselves bonded together. You don't take one ribbon and daisy chain it on another ribbon. That would just make a longer polypeptide. It would be back to being one polypeptide, only longer. You see what I'm saying? Instead, in a multimeric protein, however many polypeptides there are, each individual polypeptide remains its own ribbon with two ends. And so really a multimeric protein is more than one molecule, because each polypeptide is its own molecule, but they fit together and are held together by non-chemical bonds to give the whole system an overall shape. That's what quaternary structure is. The overall three-dimensional arrangement of all of the constituent polypeptides that make up a multimeric protein. And this is true for only certain proteins. And that's when you would not want to use the word protein and polypeptide interchangeably. This one happens, it looks like this one has maybe four overall polypeptides. By the way, however many polypeptides make up a multimeric protein, they can be either identical copies. It can be two polypeptides that are identical and then they're complex together, or more than two, or they can be different from each other, or it can be two of one, two of another. Any combination is fine. But quaternary structure refers to the overall shape. And so this whole thing is the protein, and this protein, this example, is made up of four polypeptides. Those words are different in that case. Okay, now 23. We can get back to these disulfide bridges I was mentioning earlier. It's part of this, but let's talk about the overall point of this slide. You see this purple ribbon. This is not the entire polypeptide. It's just part of it. It's kind of a generic example. It's not something, a real specific polypeptide. But anyway, the ribbon itself is not actually the entire polypeptide. The ribbon in the ribbon model represents the backbone, which is everything except the R groups that are hanging off of that ribbon. Remember that the R groups are not holding the ribbon together. The ribbon is the rest of the amino acid, the rest of the each piece of amino acid. And not every R group is shown here. They just show you an R group hanging off now and then. But there would be an R group for each amino acid along the length. The point of the slide is that depending on the chemical properties of the R groups, amino acids that are brought into proximity by bending that necklace or ribbon is going to determine whether or not those R groups want to be next to each other. So, shape is everything, as I've said, but the shape of a polypeptide is not random. The shape comes directly from the primary structure, which is the sequence of particular amino acids. So you build it not with a shape already, you just build it as a sequence of amino acids, and it will naturally take a specific three-dimensional shape because some R groups want to be around other R groups and some R groups want to avoid other R groups. That's what's going to determine the actual shape that it bends into, and that will determine the function, or will allow the function. But what we see here is that there are some four major kinds of interactions between R groups that help to stabilize or determine that conformation, which is another word for shape of the protein. For one thing, we have hydrogen bonding possible. This is one of the blue. I don't know why they used two blues. They were not out of colors yet. Hydrogen bonding is one possibility. If you have an R group that has an OH and an R group that has an OH, then those can form hydrogen bonds just like between water. I'm sorry, an OH and an O are going to be weakly attracted, just like water is weakly attracted to other water molecules, right? Hydrogen bonding because of polarity. Because of unequal sharing in this OH. Right? Now that's not a chemical bond, but it's more than nothing, and therefore it stabilizes this part of the shape because it keeps them together a little bit more, like weak magnets. You also have the possibility of something even weaker than hydrogen bonds, which are called hydrophobic interactions. And notice here, what are all of these four groups here?
Methyls.
Those are methyls. CH3. And what do I keep telling you about hydrocarbons? Which methyl group is made up of nothing but carbon and hydrogen? I keep saying the same things about hydrocarbons in general. Which is what? One thing I keep saying is that they are nonpolar. Because carbon and hydrogen have almost the same electronegativity values. So the sharing of electrons between C and H is equal. Well, you would expect, therefore, when you get two nonpolar things together, like this methyl and this methyl in two different R groups, two different amino acids, you'd expect them not to be attracted to each other, right? So why does this happen? Well, if you have, I'm just going to draw one H, a C and an H from one thing and a C and an H from another. This is just part of the group. This is equal sharing in both of these, right? But at any given moment, at any given instant in time, if you freeze the clock, the electrons that are being shared are somewhere, right? They're not actually dispersed. They are, at any given point in time, at a particular place. Well, if these electrons that are going back and forth between the carbon and the hydrogen in each of these actually start being synchronized, let's say they are down here with the H on the top one, but then they're down here with the C on the other one. For that moment, this H will be very slightly polar, and this H will be very slightly polar in the opposite way, right? Because this one has the electrons, this one doesn't. So this is slightly negative, this is slightly positive. And then a tiny fraction of a second later, it could change to this. And so now these things are still attracted, but for opposite reasons. Now this one's positive and this one's negative. And so if the electrons keep doing that in unison, you have what's called hydrophobic interactions. Hydrophobic because carbon-hydrogen bonds are nonpolar, which is hydrophobic. That's a tiny, tiny attraction, but it's still more than zero. And if you have a lot of them, they add up, which is why geckos, for instance, can walk on a glass ceiling without falling off. They have a lot of hydrophobic interactions between their feet and the glass. Yeah. Well, that is important when you try to mix the two. These two they don't dislike being around each other, but that's not what's causing the hydrophobic interactions. The hydrophobic interactions is because of electrical charge, tiny, simply because there is synchronization of the movement of the electrons. And if it weren't like that, if they were just randomly moving, then it wouldn't occur. Okay? Any questions on that? Any more questions on that? So very weak, even weaker than hydrogen bonds, but important because you have a lot of R groups with methyl groups, the ones that are the nonpolar, and if those two come into contact because of the specific way this whole thing's being bent, these are non-adjacent, meaning amino acids that aren't next to each other in the ribbon. But they get close to each other by the bending of the ribbon. And so that's one thing that can stabilize the overall shape, yeah.
Can they synchronize the other way where they repel?
Well, that's... I don't know that that happens, but it's... I don't see why it's impossible. There must be some reason why, probably because of the repulsion of the electrons here to the electrons here. That's probably why it does favor them staying away from each other in both groups. You see what I'm saying? If they went this way, then that would be repulsive force. And they don't really want to do that. Okay, next in yellow is the disulfide bridge. This is the thing I mentioned earlier in the lysozyme slide. So this CH2S wouldn't be just S before this bond is made. This would be a sulfhydryl, an SH. And this other one is the same amino acid in this other position on the ribbon, and it would also be an SH. Each one is a sulfhydryl, but when the two sulfhydryls get brought into proximity, each sulfhydryl loses its hydrogen. Imagine it in ball and stick models, that would leave a hole in each S. And you can therefore put a stick between the two S's. That's a covalent bond. So that is much, much stronger than these two up here. And so disulfide bridges, if they occur in a polypeptide, they don't have to, but they do in certain polypeptides. That's really going to stabilize the structure because it's such a strong bond. For instance, you see a lot of this in your hair, which is why hair can be so strong. And this is also why if you accidentally or intentionally burn your hair, it smells like sulfur. A lot of disulfide bridges in there. And then the fourth one, which uses the same blue again, but is a different kind of bond, is an ionic bond. So this uses those ionic, that electrically charged group of amino acids. If you get a negatively charged one matched up against a positively charged one, then just like a sodium ion attracts a chloride ion, those are going to be ionically bonded, and that's going to stabilize it as well. And therefore, the overall combination of all these particular associations between non-adjacent R groups is what actually determines the shape, which is why if you just have an assembly line, which the cell does, building this same exact sequence, the same primary structure, all of those copies are going to end up folding into the same shape for chemical reasons because of the way the R groups interact with each other. All right, now to 24. Collagen and hemoglobin are just two examples here. That's nothing really important about these as far as what the slide is trying to stress. What we see here, though, is using examples, is the fact that proteins in general can be structurally lumped into one of two categories. There are the so-called fibrous proteins, which collagen is an example of. And notice that collagen also happens to be an example of a multimeric protein, because each one of these three strands is its own polypeptide. Now, fibrous proteins don't have to be multimeric, but fibrous proteins get their name simply because they're like fibers. They're long in one direction. And they act like little ropes. They're mostly structural in function. They form structures, just like ropes have high tensile strength. They can't be stretched very easily. Collagen can't be either as a fibrous protein. And then the other major category for shape are the globular proteins. Globular proteins aren't particularly long in one direction. They are like a compact mass, not necessarily a perfect circle or perfect sphere, but, you know, just compact. And those are what most enzymes, for instance, are, globular proteins. But there's all kinds of other examples of globular proteins. They're not really so much for forming structures. Some of them can be. They do other things. The hemoglobin here is another example of a multimeric protein. So each of your billions of red blood cells, each individual one, contains millions of these hemoglobins, each of which is four molecules, actually. It's complex together because it's four polypeptides making up one hemoglobin. And that's why a single hemoglobin, which we call, it's not technically right to say that hemoglobin is one molecule, right? It's four, really. Two copies of one kind of polypeptide and two copies of another. But because there's four overall, that's why an individual hemoglobin can carry up to four oxygen molecules, which is its function in blood, its major function in blood. And there's millions of those in one invisible cell times billions of those cells in your blood. So there's a hell of a lot of hemoglobin in here. Okay, 25. This uses hemoglobin as an example as well. But the point here is how important primary structure is. All of those higher levels of protein structure, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, if it exists, all of those are consequences of or depend on primary structure. So if you don't build the necklace right to begin with, either it's too short or too long, or you have the wrong order, then the shape is going to be wrong. All those other higher levels are going to be wrong. That's shown here with hemoglobin as an example. You have just a little bit of the protein shown here, just the first seven amino acids. And this is only the first seven amino acids of just one of the four polypeptides involved. There's two identical polypeptides, the light purple, and then there's two other polypeptides which aren't shown here by this sequence. Okay, but notice it fades out. So this polypeptide is more than seven amino acids long. This is just showing you the first seven. Valine, histidine, leucine, and so on. Normal here means that's what most humans have, and it functions normally as a carrier of oxygen and carbon dioxide. But it functions for what hemoglobin is supposed to do in the blood. All right, now on the right you have hemoglobin from someone with sickle cell disease. And notice the similarity. And all the ones after seven are the same in both. They just don't show them. So the sickle cell protein, which is what causes sickle cell disease, is almost exactly correct as far as primary structure is concerned. Instead of number six, which was supposed to be glutamic acid as the amino acid, the cell put valine there instead. Why did it do that, by the way? Just following orders. The gene is defective in that person. The gene determines the sequence of amino acids. The gene tells the cell how to build the necklace. Okay, so in this person, the cell thinks there's supposed to be valine there because it got the instruction for that. That's only one amino acid different, but that makes a big difference because that changes how the R groups interact, and therefore the overall shape of the protein is going to be different. Specifically, that polypeptide of the multimeric protein, which is hemoglobin. The other two subunits are normal, by the way, but the overall collection of the four subunits, the whole hemoglobin, in other words, is now so misshapen that it can't carry oxygen very well, which is one of the reasons the disease is so bad for you. But that also causes individual hemoglobins to clump together within the cell, and they're not supposed to do that. And that causes an overall misshapen cell. This is a normal erythrocyte or red blood cell. It's a biconcave disc. It's like a jelly donut that's caved in a little bit on each side. This is a sickle cell. Has a drastically different shape because of this clumping together of the hemoglobins that are wrong. All right, so shape is everything, but it all springs from primary structure. Now, more about shape is shown in 26. What did I say the other word for the shape of a protein is? Conformation. So shape is everything is the same thing as saying conformation is everything. Only if the polypeptide has the correct conformation will it function properly. But even though I just told you that that conformation or that shape depends on the primary structure, that's not the only thing it depends on. You have to have that primary structure correct if you have any hope of having the shape correct. But there's other things besides that can affect the shape, like temperature and pH, as I've mentioned before. So if you get outside of the allowable limits, temperature too high or too low, pH too high or too low, even though you have the right sequence of amino acids, the shape will be wrong because it's going to affect the chemical properties of those R groups and how they interact with each other. And so we have a normal protein on the left here. Not only is the sequence right, but the conditions are right for it to have that shape. If, for instance, temperature or pH, or those are the two biggies, there are other variables that can affect this as well. But if any variable in the environment gets too far, if it gets out of allowable limits, we have a loss of shape or a change into a non-functional shape, which is called denaturation.
Which is why homeostasis is important.
Right, it's one of the most important parts of homeostasis is to make sure that your proteins have the right shape so that they can continue to keep you alive. Denaturation is loss of that shape. And if the denaturation is drastic, like if the temperature gets really hot, for instance, then it's going to be permanent. If it's not so drastic, it will lose its shape and therefore not function as well while it's in that misshape. But if you restore the conditions to normal, it can sometimes go back into its normal shape for the same reason that it took on that shape when it was first built. That's called renaturation. But you have to. That happens only if it's not too drastic a change. Now consider this with what happens when you cook. I just use meat as an example, just because it has a lot of protein. Other foods have protein in them as well, but meat is very protein rich because it's muscle, skeletal muscle from whatever animal. Well, if you cook that, it has a totally different texture, right? And that's because of denaturation. You've heated it up, and you've changed the shape of those proteins. Notice, though, that if you cook that steak and decide, actually, I'm not as hungry as I thought, you can't just put it back in the refrigerator and have it become a raw steak again. It's too drastic for it to renature. That's a permanent loss of function. If that happens in a living organism, those proteins are worthless. Well, they're worthless for doing that function. They're still valuable for raw materials. The cell can say, okay, this one's never going to work, but I can break it down into individual amino acids and build another protein out of those. Okay? Oh, notice also, by the way, that you don't really have to heat things up to denature them. If you put lemon juice onto raw fish, it's kind of like it cooks it, right, without raising the temperature. Well, you're using acid from the lemon. That's a pH change. So that denatures those proteins. Okay. 27. Here we have a case of proteins helping other proteins. Now, typically, a polypeptide, once it's built by a cell, will by itself assume that correct shape because of things I've been telling you. The R group interactions will give it the right shape without any help. Sometimes, though, certain polypeptides do need help because conditions within the main chamber of the cell are not right for it to get its right shape. And so there are some proteins that the body builds that are built for the purpose of helping other new proteins assume their right shape or conformation. And those are called chaperone proteins. Chaperonin is just the name of a chaperone protein. And these proteins have a shape kind of like a little canister. So the chaperone protein is the canister here. This brand new polypeptide, notice, hasn't folded up yet. It has its primary structure, but it's not yet in the shape it should assume. If you insert it into this chaperone protein, that gets it away from the environment of the cell so that it can fold up into its proper shape and then can be released. Only if you do that, though, will this thing function for whatever it does. A transition slide, in a sense, because it's the end of the protein section. So that's three of the four macromolecules. Which kind of macromolecule have we not yet talked about? Nucleic acids. And so this slide serves as the end of proteins and as the beginning of nucleic acids because they're so cooperative, in a sense. What we have here is a schematic representation how it happens in a eukaryote. It would be the same in a prokaryote, except there wouldn't be a nucleus here. But it shows you the relationship between nucleic acids and proteins. Nucleic acids include DNA and RNA, and both of those kinds of nucleic acids are involved in telling the cell how to build proteins or how to build a polypeptide. Okay? A gene is just a part of the overall length of DNA. It's enough information to tell the cell how to build one polypeptide. Actually, that's only indirectly true, though. What a gene directly tells a cell how to build is not a polypeptide, but an RNA molecule, a different nucleic acid. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. We'll talk about that more later. RNA stands for ribonucleic acid. It's a different kind of nucleic acid. So one gene tells the cell how to build an RNA molecule. This RNA is called messenger RNA or mRNA because it is transmitting a message in the form of how to build a polypeptide. Once that mRNA is produced, DNA's job is done in this process. mRNA now is holding the information to how to directly build the polypeptide. And that involves the mRNA meeting up with a specific kind of organelle called a ribosome, the brown thing here. The ribosome is a little molecular machine that actually assembles the polypeptide, one amino acid at a time, but it does so by reading the sequence of nucleotides, the monomers, that make up the mRNA. So the information in the nucleic acid is the specific sequence of nucleotides that make it up. The ribosome reads that sequence, and then using the code, knows what the sequence of amino acids needs to be. And the polypeptide is assembled one amino acid at a time. We'll talk a lot more about that overall process, which is called gene expression, in the second half of the term, where we're going to spend the whole second half studying DNA. Okay, now we're officially into the nucleic acids portion. This is the last of the four sections of this chapter. And what did I say is roughly another name for nucleic acid? Not nucleotide, importantly, but polynucleotide. All right, so remember the three polymer categories of the four overall. Which one is not a polymer? Lipids. The others are, though, and if you use the most descriptive words for them, it tells you that. Polysaccharides are polymers made out of monosaccharides. Polypeptides are polymers made out of amino acids that are hooked together by peptide bonds. Polynucleotides are polymers made out of monomers called nucleotides. Okay? So what we're looking at here on the left is a very small polynucleotide because there's only four nucleotides that have been put together. One DNA, which is the DNA that's in just one of your chromosomes in one cell, which you have trillions of copies of because you have trillions of cells. Just one DNA, though, from one chromosome is millions of nucleotides long, not four. So this is a tiny nucleic acid, but they're built, no matter how long they are, the same way, by an end-to-end arrangement of nucleic acids. So the same thing is true for polynucleotides as it was for polypeptides. There's only one way to hook the two monomers together. It's an end-to-end, non-branching arrangement. Polysaccharides can branch, they don't have to. Polypeptides can't branch, and polynucleotides can't branch. So they also can be depicted as a ribbon, to remind you of that fact. All right, so you have four nucleotides here hooked together, but in the middle we see a close-up of just one of the nucleotides. A nucleotide is also considered a nucleic acid, by the way. And this is why that word is really not appropriate for macromolecules, just like carbohydrate is not the right word, right? Not all carbohydrates are macromolecules. Well, not all nucleic acids are macromolecules, because a single nucleotide is a nucleic acid. And while we're at it, why are they called nucleic acids? What does that mean? Right, that's where they were discovered, inside the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. That's where you find the DNA. Now, prokaryotic cells have DNA as well. They just don't have a nucleus. But anyway, that's how they got the name nucleic acids. Now, one nucleotide is shown here. That's one monomer. But there has, just like there has to be certain things in place for something to be an amino acid, there has to be certain things in place for that thing to be a nucleotide. A nucleotide has three major parts to it. It's one monomer, but it itself has three parts, all right, three components to one nucleotide. And one of those is a pentose sugar. What does the word pentose tell you? Means that it's a sugar with five carbons. Yes. So pentose is not a specific substance, it's a category. There are multiple pentoses. Well, in biology, there are two different kinds of pentoses that can be used, which determines the two major subcategories of nucleic acids. I told you earlier that the two major kinds of nucleic acids are DNA and RNA. The difference is which pentose sugar you use to build them, which sugar is featured in the nucleus, nucleotides that make them up, in other words. So, pentose is the general term. We'll get into the difference between the pentoses in a minute. But that's one component of a nucleotide, a five-carbon sugar. And I mention that first because the other two components of the nucleotide are each individually connected to that sugar, but in different places. One of the things that's connected is a phosphate group, as you can see here. And if you just had the sugar and the phosphate, it would not be a complete nucleotide, because you also have to have, connected to that same sugar, some sort of nitrogenous base. Now, nitrogenous simply means containing nitrogen. All right? If you have all three of these things, a nitrogenous base connected to a sugar, and at least one phosphate connected to that same sugar, then what you have is a nucleotide. Notice the bracket here. It's listed as nucleoside. Be careful with those two terms, because they only differ in one letter. Nucleoside refers to just the nitrogenous base and the sugar. So another way of saying it in language is that a nucleotide is a nucleoside with at least one phosphate hooked to it. In other words, we can call a nucleoside phosphate. Okay, that's true of any nucleotide, and then you hook those together end to end to make up either an RNA or a DNA molecule, a polynucleotide. Let's discuss the two sugars possible, the two pentose sugars. Organisms use two pentoses to build their nucleic acids. One possibility is ribose, which is the one shown with the red text down here in the lower right. The other is deoxyribose, and that is the basis for the names of the two categories. Deoxyribonucleic acid is DNA. Ribonucleic acid is RNA. But look at these two structural formulae, deoxyribose and ribose. Almost identical, right? What is the only difference? Do you see it? Don't look at the names, look at the formulae. Right here, yes. This is an OH in ribose at corner number 2. The 2 prime here refers to the fact that this is the second carbon. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so at the second carbon, there's an OH in ribose. But in deoxyribose, it's not an OH, it's just an H. And that's why it's called deoxyribose. It's just like ribose without the oxygen, deoxyribose. All right? Now, if you are building a polynucleotide, either DNA or RNA, every one of the nucleotides is going to have the same sugar. In other words, a DNA, however long it is, has nucleotides, all of its nucleotides feature deoxyribose. If you're building an RNA, every one of the nucleotides will have ribose, so it's not mix and match. It's one or the other, depending on which kind of overall nucleic acid you're building. Okay, so in other words, within a polynucleotide, there is no variability to the sugar component. It's going to be exactly the same for however long the polynucleotide is. Just like in amino acids, there's no variability to the carboxyls. They're all the same in every amino acid, right? The only variable part of amino acids was the R group. Well, sugar is not variable. There's two choices, but there's only one choice within that type of nucleic acid. Similarly, all phosphate groups are the same. So there is no variability with respect to a phosphate. Sugar and the phosphate are the same for however many nucleotides you use. What this means is that the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides when you're building a nucleic acid is that there are different kinds of nitrogenous bases that can be used. And those are shown in the upper right. There's more possibilities, but these are the five main types that are in normal DNA and normal RNA. There's five overall, notice. Cytosine, thymine, uracil, adenine, guanine are all listed here. But DNA uses only four of those five, and RNA uses only four of those five. So obviously, since there's five total, there's overlap in what they use, right? Both RNA and DNA use adenine, guanine, cytosine. Okay? DNA uses thymine also, in addition to those three. So A, G, C, and T is in DNA. RNA uses adenine, guanine, cytosine, and uracil instead of thymine. So A, C, U, and G. But what that means is that if you're building a polynucleotide, there are four kinds of beads rather than the 20 kinds of amino acids. If you're stringing them together, you have four different choices of beads, four different nucleotides, because you're using four kinds of nitrogenous bases. That's the nitrogenous base is the variable part of the nucleotide. Okay, there's another similarity with R groups on amino acids when you build a polypeptide. Look at this end-to-end arrangement on the left of this polynucleotide. What holds this thing together, what holds all each of the nucleotides together, is what's called overall the sugar phosphate backbone. And that's because the sugar of one amino acid, of one nucleotide, is connected to the phosphate of the next nucleotide. So sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, for however many nucleotides there are. That's called the sugar phosphate backbone because that is the only thing that holds this sequence together as a particular strand. That's really important because this is an informational molecule. All right? What is the information? The specific sequence of nucleotides. The A's, T's, C's, and G's. It can be any order. But unless you have that order established and kept permanent, the information will be lost, right? So you don't want that sequence to be randomized. You would lose that sequence if this thing fell apart. So the sugar phosphate backbone needs to be strong. It's made out of covalent bonds between the sugar of one nucleotide and the phosphate of the next nucleotide. That keeps the integrity of the information. This is analogous in polypeptides to the amino of one amino acid being hooked to the carboxyl of the next amino acid, and that's the only way you can do it. Okay? And it's the only thing that holds them together, remember. And similar to proteins also, the variable part of the monomer, which in this case is the nitrogenous base, is not at all involved in holding the thing together along its length, and instead just hangs off of the backbone, just like the R groups collectively making up the side chain of a polypeptide is not at all involved in holding it together. They're just hanging off of the chain. So each of these orange things is a nitrogenous base, not at all holding it together. But important, because the nitrogenous bases, since they're the only variable part, is what gives you the sequence, right? If you didn't have that variable part, then the sequence would just be like using one letter only. The only different codes you could have is how many A's you have. It would all be A's, right? For it to actually be a code, you have to have different kinds of letters. You have A's, C's, T's, and G's. That's what these are. And the particular order that they are in is the actual information that it's carrying. Now, the only other thing I haven't mentioned about these nitrogenous bases... What's the real time? Oh, wait a minute. What is the actual time? Is this correct? So that's pretty close, closer than mine. The only thing I haven't mentioned about this brown box of nitrogenous bases is that there's five overall, like I said, but there are two categories, subcategories of nitrogenous bases, which are the pyrimidines and the purines. And compare the structural formulae. What you see is that the pyrimidines all feature one ring in the structure. The purines feature two rings. And that'll be important as we go on and talk more about DNA. But let me end the chapter with slide 30, which shows you a particular nucleic acid called DNA. This is DNA, if you haven't already figured that out. It's probably have figured that out because DNA is the most famous molecule in the world, or big molecule. DNA, you know, when we use the word a DNA, it's technically not correct to say it's a molecule of DNA, because a single DNA, just like a multimeric protein, is multiple molecules. It's a double-stranded nucleic acid, DNA is. Each individual strand of the two, though, is a molecule in its own right. So just like a multimeric protein is made up of two or more polypeptides, DNA is made up of two polynucleotides, and each polynucleotide is its own molecule. Because each polynucleotide, each strand in that one DNA, is a polymer made out of an end-to-end arrangement of nucleotides. DNA, though, is double-stranded. RNA, typically, is single-stranded. So it's also a nucleic acid, but it's just one polynucleotide big, however long it is. DNA is two polynucleotides that are then held together. And what holds the two strands together is not strong bonds, importantly, and not, therefore, chemical bonds. It's what's represented here by black ellipses. These three dots represents a hydrogen bond, which you already know is weak and not actually a chemical bond, which is why these things are still considered to be separate molecules, just like two water molecules are still separate, even though they're attracted to each other by a hydrogen bond. The hydrogen bonding between the two strands holds them together into the overall complete double-stranded DNA, which is not only two strands, but is twisted. The two strands are twisted, so it's a double helix. Each strand is a helix, or corkscrew shape, but you have two of them. And so they're very similar. Notice that each one is depicted by a ribbon for the sugar phosphate backbone, holding it together. And then hanging off of that ribbon are the nitrogenous bases, the only variable part, the A's, C's, T's, and G's. So the rib, the backbones are kind of like the structural part of a spiral staircase. And then each step on the staircase is made up of a nitrogenous base from connected to one strand and a nitrogenous base in the same position connected to the other strand. So it's like a ladder that you twist. And once you twist that ladder, you have a double helix. DNA is informational as well because it's made up of a sequence of particular nucleotides. But as I said before, a gene, which is some part of this length, some sequence of A's, C's, T's, and G's, tells the cell directly how to build a messenger RNA. DNA's job is done, and then messenger RNA is now holding a sequence that tells the cell directly how to build a polypeptide. That's why DNA indirectly gives organisms their traits, because it indirectly tells the cell how to build the proteins, and the proteins directly give the organism its traits. All right. By the way, we're done, even though there's a slide, because 31 is one of these summary slides that some of these chapters feature. So it's stuff I've already talked about, but I leave it up there because you might want to study with it.